Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison, Random House, New York, New York, 1947. This is a realistic work of psychological fiction, set in the Deep South in New York City during the 1930s. The work features the Invisible Man, who is an unnamed black man in search of his identity, the president of a Negro college, Dr. Bledsoe, Mr. Norton, who is a white philanthropic contributor to the college, Brother Jack, leader of the Brotherhood, a white group preaching nonviolence to blacks, and Ross the Exhorter, a West Indian black nationalist. I am an invisible man. I am invisible, understand, simply because people refuse to see me. All my life I have been looking for myself and asking everyone except myself questions which I, and only I, could answer. The invisible man was the intelligent and soft-spoken grandson of black slaves. At his high school graduation, he explained, I delivered an oration in which I showed that humility was the secret, indeed, the very essence of progress. He was asked to repeat the speech at a gathering of the town's leading white citizens. Upon arriving, I was told that since I was to be there anyway, I might as well take part in the battle royal slated for the night's entertainment. He and his black companions were blindfolded, placed in a ring, and goaded to fight by men in the audience. Kill him! Kill him! Slug him, black boy! They called. Before he realized it, only he and one other boy, Tatlock, the biggest of the gang, were left in the ring. Tatlock pummeled his rival until he hit the mat. The fight was over. The face and the dignity of the young man were shattered. When the bloody, sweaty, humiliated youth finally did give his speech, no one really listened. The onlookers returned to their talking and drinking. Frustrated, the invisible man spoke two words that silenced the crowd: social equality. Laughter hung smoke-like in the sudden stillness. The men turned on him, forcing him to recant. You sure that about equality was a mistake? The MC asked. Oh, yes, sir. I was swallowing blood. But the young man was allowed to finish his speech and was afterwards handed a calfskin briefcase. Boy, take this prize and keep it well. Someday it will be filled with important papers that will help shape the destiny of your people. Inside the briefcase was a scholarship to a nearby Negro college. The invisible man did well in school. Success was just within his reach. A success that depended on humility and conformity, on invisibility. Then in his junior year, the eager young man was asked to serve as a chauffeur for visiting dignitaries. One day, while driving off campus with a Mr. Norton, one of the school's white benefactors, they passed some log cabins. Mr. Norton could not quite believe it when the Negro student explained that these cabins dated back to the times of slavery. He demanded that they stop at one particular cabin, but the boy hesitated. Jim Trueblood, who had scandalized the black community by having a child with his own daughter, lived in that cabin. But Norton insisted that they stop and talk. After hearing Trueblood's story, the white man appeared to faint. I might have a stimulant, young man. A little whiskey, he groaned as they drove on. Now the only place nearby to get whiskey was the Golden Day, a combination tavern and brothel. When the bartender there would not let the black student buy whiskey, he returned to the car, only to find his passenger barely breathing, lying like a figure of chalk. Frantically, the invisible man rushed back in the tavern for help. After being carried inside, the old man finally came around. As he sipped some brandy, drunkards, prostitutes, and lunatics crowded around him, nearly breaking into a riot with their shoving and gutter talk. When Dr. Bledsoe, president of the college, found out about the incident, he exploded. Boy, are you serious? Why that Trueblood shack? You're black and living in the South. Did you forget how to lie? The invisible man tried to defend his actions, but Bledsoe pronounced his sentence. Boy, I want you to go to New York for the summer and save your pride and your money. You go there and earn your next year's fees. The following day, Bledsoe handed him some letters of recommendation and a list of job contacts. On his way north, the invisible man resolved to work hard and serve my employer so well that he would shower Dr. Bledsoe with favorable reports and I would save my money and return in the fall full of New York culture. I'd be indisputably the leading campus figure. However, in New York, the young man's job search proved curiously fruitless. Secretaries would take his letters, disappear into an office, and then come out and tell the young man that they would let him know if anything came up. Finally, after a number of interviews, the young man was asked if he had read Bledsoe's introductory letter. No, he hadn't. The letters had been sealed. Now he found that they all began, "The bearer is a former student of ours. I say former because he shall never be enrolled as a student again. It is to the best interests of the great work which we are dedicated to perform that he continue undisturbed in his vain hopes while remaining as far as possible from our midst." As the young man sat dumbfounded, the embarrassed interviewer recommended a paint factory where he might apply for a job. Liberty Paints hired the invisible man. "The wise guy's firing the regular guys and putting on you colored college boys. Pretty smart," was the first comment he heard. "That way they don't have to pay union wages." Sent to the basement as a janitorial assistant, the young man was given the job of watching the paint gauges. He got along reasonably well with his crusty boss, Brockway, until lunchtime, when he was detained at a union meeting he had accidentally walked in on. As he faced his supervisor and tried to explain the delay, Brockway smacked him. Suddenly the boy's mind snapped in anger and frustration, and he knocked Brockway's dentures across the floor. Just then they heard a shrill whistling sound. The invisible man grabbed at the gauge valves, but too late. I seemed to run swiftly up an incline and shot forward with sudden acceleration into a wet bath of whiteness. When he awoke, he was in a hospital room, hooked up to a menagerie of electrical devices. He couldn't even remember his name. Later, he was released and given some compensation checks to tide him over. But as he emerged from the darkness of the subway, he passed out. A woman named Mary helped him up and took him to her home to rest. The rest turned into a stay of several months. Mary was a kind and generous woman. But when his compensation checks ran out, the invisible man began to feel guilty. Gradually, he lost faith in himself. Then one day while he was wandering around Harlem, he saw an old couple being evicted from their apartment. A crowd had gathered at the scene, and some of them were attacking the white man directing the eviction. But the invisible man stepped in and began to speak. "We're a law-abiding people, and a slow-to-anger people." Soon he had the crowd under control. His words had attracted some other whites, and when the police showed up looking for black suspects, these whites and scattered blacks, members of an organization called the Brotherhood, helped him escape. Brother Jack, their spokesman, complimented the invisible man on his eloquence. Because of his exceptional gift with words, Brother Jack hired him on the spot as the movement's new black spokesman. The first speech the invisible man gave for the Brotherhood was an electrifying masterpiece. Many members of the group, however, complained that this black man was appealing essentially to the crowd's emotions, while their organization believed in rational persuasion. "The audience isn't thinking. It's yelling its head off." So Brother Jack decided that the Brotherhood's newest brother would undergo a period of intense study and indoctrination. For the next few months, white brothers, some filled with guilt, some looking for a social cause, and still others dedicated to freeing blacks, smothered the invisible man with ideology. They spoke of the black repossessing their heritage and banding together in brotherhood to unite the races. The training period over, Brother Jack appointed his new charismatic speaker as leader of the group's Harlem district. "The Brotherhood was a world within a world," the invisible man said, "and I was determined to discover all its secrets and to advance as far as I could." With a new identity and confidence, he went into the ghettos to preach peace. But confrontations with a rival group, the Black Nationalist Gang, soon flared up. Both sides claimed Harlem as their territory. The Nationalists were led by a man named Ross the Exhorter, a West Indian committed to the extermination of whites and Uncle Toms. "You're black, African," he constantly reminded his fellow ghetto dwellers in a bid to win them over as his people. Then one day, Brother Clifton, an important and influential Brotherhood supporter, disappeared. With Clifton gone, Ross and his gang gained a stronghold in Harlem. The invisible man was called in to repair the damage. While walking through Harlem, he spotted Brother Clifton selling dancing black Sambo dolls. Clifton could not even look him in the eye. Later, Brother Clifton was killed in an arrest attempt. When the Invisible Man used his funeral as a forum against police violence, Brother Jack scolded him for celebrating a man who sold racist dolls. "You're not hired to think. You are hired to talk," he chided in an ironic about-face. Finally, Harlem erupted. Clifton's death and other similar incidents, combined with the inflammatory words of Ross the Exhorter, pushed the black community over the edge. Now, Ross the Exhorter became Ross the Destroyer, taking to the streets with his followers in an all-out offensive against the white man. The Brotherhood abandoned the Invisible Man. They had no more use for him. However, even as the Invisible Man saw how he had been used and betrayed, he also saw himself more clearly. He had lived his life up to that point under an assumed identity. He had never known who he was. Now, finally, he understood the source of his invisibility. He saw Bledsoe, Norton, Brother Jack, and Ross as all the same man, all destroyers bent on hatred instead of understanding, focused on color, blind to character. Blacks have experienced exceptional prejudice, which has united them under a strong sense of purpose. However, most people experience some sort of invisibility, some deep lack of acknowledgement in the world, which can help them relate to this book and to the extreme situations encountered by the Invisible Man. With its plethora of insights, Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man is perhaps the most important black novel of the 20th century.